Welcome to Nightlights. I'm David Brent Johnson. It was America in the 1920s, a place where Wall Street was on the rise, cops were on the take, jazz was in the air, and alcohol had been banished. But it certainly hadn't vanished. Historian Michael McGurr joins us to talk about the romance and the reality of this fabled time. And we'll also hear the music of Bix Beiderbecke, Duke Ellington, Louis Armstrong, Bessie Smith, and more. It's the Big Speakeasy, Jazz in the Age of Prohibition, coming up next on Nightlights. Louis Armstrong and his Hot Five doing Hotter Than That in December 1927 at the height of America's Prohibition era. Lonnie Johnson joining on guitar and also on some of the scatting, and Kid Ory heard on trombone as well. That recording taken from the jazz anthology That Devlin Tune, Volume 1, and it generally turns up on any decent Armstrong Hot Fives and Sevens collection. Historian Michael McGurr on Prohibition, the attempt in the 1920s to banish alcohol from American life.
Prohibition comes in at a point when modern entertainment is a massive interconnected business that draws together different kinds of media, different kinds of settings, has really been put in place. And part of what it's selling is, as always with entertainment, is excitement. And some of that excitement is the excitement of pushing the envelope, of breaking the rules. And Prohibition enforces that, creates the possibility, because it's not just drinking anymore, it's breaking the law. But remember, prohibition is in place precisely because an awful lot of Americans are ambivalent about commercial, what they would call commercialized leisure, paying money to go outside the home to indulge in various kinds of pleasures. And there's a, prohibition is often presented as somehow being stupid. It wasn't stupid. It may have been ill-conceived as a policy, but it was born out of a sense of concerns that many people had that were real about what it would mean to have so much of leisure take place outside the home and built around the exchange of money. And so, as I say, prohibition is exciting to people, but it's also a product of their own fear that breaking loose from cultural norms would be problematic.
On January 16, 1920, alcohol became illegal in the United States of America. That same year, Mamie Smith recorded Crazy Blues, which would sell a million copies and help pave the way for the music media explosion of the 1920s, a decade often called the Jazz Age, but one you could simply call the Age of Sound, because suddenly sound was everywhere in the form of radio, phonographs, and by 1927, talking pictures. Jazz was indeed a big part of that sound, and with the coming of Prohibition, it flourished in the underground bars known as speakeasies around the country. A new music born in a time of complexity and change, and now aligned, for better or worse, with a culture of forbidden liquor that also gave rise to organized crime. Historian Michael McGurr, author of A Fierce Discontent, The Rise and Fall of the Progressive Movement in America, 1870 to 1920, on the impact of that relationship.
The main thing that, that Prohibition does for jazz is to intensify this cultural association with the lives of outsiders or of people on the edge, people who are playing at the limits of what's acceptable in society. And so jazz, which is already seen as a quintessentially modern force, the music of the automobile and the railroad, becomes even more in public conception the music of a more modern and avant-garde even style of life. And that's an exciting association. But the paradox is that while it has those associations, in many ways, even as it's so appealing, it's harder for many people to reach it. That jazz is taken out of some fairly respectable venues that it had been in before. And musicians can be in speakeasies, or they have to find new settings. They find colleges, fraternities. They find, as well, dance bands. The 20s is a great age of hot dance bands that that take in jazz musicians, make them play waltzes and all sorts of things, and then occasionally stand up and play 16 bars hot as a solo. So, as I said, there's a funny prohibition gives and it takes away, or it takes away and gives to jazz musicians. The first big popular jazz act that crosses over for white audiences is the original Dixieland Jazz Band, and they play in New York City at a pioneering cabaret owned by a German-American named Reisenweber, and you could go there, drink beer. It's got a kind of German beer garden ancestry to it. And that's respectable. It becomes unrespectable with Prohibition. And Reisenweber is closed down. There are complaints under the Volstead Act to shut him down. So jazz loses settings like that in Prohibition. So you either really have to go to the other side into illegality, or you had to find it in the most polite settings in big bands like Paul Whiteman.
Mm-hmm. had a drink, will do.
I'm with you.
If I had a drink, just a little drink, then I wouldn't feel so blue.
Oh, how dry I am.
Don't you really think we ought to have a drink? Just a little drink with you. For it's always fair weather when good fellows get together with a sign on the table. Ha! And a good song ringing clear.
Paul Whiteman Orchestra in 1925 doing Just a Little Drink. Paul Whiteman, the so-called King of Jazz, led one of the 1920s most popular jazz ensembles, playing a wide variety of music that ranged from popular novelty-oriented numbers to ambitious programmatic pieces, all as a part of Whiteman's bid to create what he called symphonic jazz. In 1927, Whiteman would enlist one of the jazz age's most talented figures, the young cornetist Bix Beiderbecke, who would die just 4 years later at the age of 28 from the effects of alcoholism, Michael McGurr.
Part of the romantic notion of jazz and prohibition is of the lost musician who becomes an alcoholic, a drunk. And much more so than the stuff about gangsters, there's a basis of truth in that. There are an awful lot of young musicians who become serious alcoholics in the 20s to the point of self-destruction. Most famously, Bix Beiderbecke, the great cornet player from Davenport, Iowa. Tommy and Jimmy Dorsey become lifelong alcoholics, starting out as popular young musicians in the 20s. Tommy Dorsey would die in 1956 from the effects of drinking too much. Bunny Berrigan, arguably one of the greatest trumpet players in the history of jazz, his career becomes a wreck in the 1930s because of the habits he picked up in the 20s, which is not a lot of finger wagging about the evils of drink, but as a reminder that jazz musicians did live on the edges of a culture that was very new and difficult to negotiate. And it's ironic that the music paid a very heavy price in terms of the talent that it lost over time from the habits of a generation that grew up in prohibition. Thank you.
Vic Spiderbeck in 1925 doing his composition Davenport Blues from Vic's Restored Volume 1. That recording made in Richmond, Indiana on a cold January day. The band included a young Tommy Dorsey, and the date produced only two usable numbers, in large part because the musicians put away three quarts of gin. Beiderbecke came from a middle-class background, and his family had difficulty understanding the jazz world to which he was drawn. Michael McGurr says the middle class in general was more ambivalent, though, about jazz and liquor than the social forces that had propelled Prohibition into being.
There were all different kinds of temperance and Prohibition advocates, some of them rural and more fundamentalist, who simply saw liquor as a matter of sin. There are more middle class types who saw drink as problematic because of the other vices, in quotes, with which it was associated, like prostitution, gambling. There was a sense that alcohol lubricated the vice machine overall, and that was the big objection to it. Middle class people were ambivalent about liquor. They saw the liquor trade as a problem, but they didn't think drink was inherently sinful. They saw jazz music as, in somewhat similar terms, as being quite appealing, but also bound up in a kind of commercial apparatus of pleasure, including drink, that gave them pause.
If Vic Spiderbecke symbolized the tragic, darker side of Prohibition-era jazz, pianist Jelly Roll Morton ultimately embodied a less troubled embrace of that commercial apparatus of pleasure. A true jazz pioneer of arranging and composing, Morton has also become the stuff of legend for his alleged activities as a pimp, pool shark, and hustler, a legend fed to some degree by his own remembrances that he recorded for the Library of Congress in 1938. Here he is in 1926 doing his composition, Grandpa's Spells. Jelly Roll Morton and his Red Hot Peppers in 1926 doing Grandpa's Spells from the anthology That Devlin Tune, Volume 1. Historian Michael McGurr on the role jazz played in Prohibition America and what it reflected of the times.
Well, the standard answer would be that jazz simultaneously embodies two very different or almost conflicting sensibilities in American culture. On one hand, jazz is associated with primitivism. It's seen as the music of African Americans, of people who, and you know the the kinds of racial stereotypes, racist stereotypes that are bound up in that, but people out of the jungle, literally calling this jungle music. So rooted in human desire, sexualized. So there's that image of jazz. And at the same time, it's seen as the epitome of modernism, as the perfect musical accompaniment to an increasingly slick, modernized society of steel skyscrapers, steel rails, automobiles, and all sorts of progress. And people, at a time when the United States especially was seen as the absolute center of this kind of industrial modernity, jazz is the obvious cultural counterpart to that in the United States. So jazz has this peculiar identity, which is why I think it's so powerful, that it's associated with two very strong senses about American life and culture that are in tension with each other, primitive and modern.
Duke Ellington's Black and Tan Fantasy, recorded in 1927 from the CD Early Ellington. Its title a reference not to the drink, which did already exist, but to speakeasies that permitted and even encouraged interracial mingling. Issues of race and ethnicity came more to the forefront in the 1920s, with tensions rising over immigration and the migration of African Americans to the North, while the Harlem Renaissance began to elevate the cultural profile of Black Americans. The Ku Klux Klan gained in membership and influence. Michael McGurr says these issues became visible in the depiction of some of the era's most memorable personalities, the gangsters, who ran many of the clubs where musicians played, and who are often fans of the music and friends with the artists who played it.
Gangsters are part of the romance of Prohibition and the culture generally, and it's no surprise they're part of the romance about jazz music. Inevitably, they were going to come together, and there are delightful stories about gangsters protecting musicians or being demanding. Though, you know, it's really not as if Al Capone is sitting there saying, you either play Ain't Misbehaving or else. But again, it adds to this image of jazz as the music of outsiders and of not just law breaking, but of kind of pushing the edges of the culture. And remember what the image of a gangster is in that period. It's of a Jew or an Italian. Again, cultural outsiders still.
One artist who had a rather infamous run-in with gangsters was Louis Armstrong, who left Chicago in 1931 because of a mob-related issue and headed back to his hometown of New Orleans, eventually spending some time in Europe as well in order to avoid the organized crime heat. In 1929, Armstrong made one of jazz's first interracial recordings with the young trombonist and singer Jack Teagarden that serves as an appropriate musical talisman for this show. The tune they recorded, Knockin' a Jug, had been written in part by banjoist Eddie Condon, but ironically enough, Condon was too drunk to make the date. Here's Louis Armstrong with Jack Teagarden doing Knockin' a Jug on Nightlights. Louis Armstrong and Jack Teagarden doing Knockin' a Jug with Eddie Lang on guitar, recorded in 1929, one of jazz's first interracial recordings. I'll have more jazz from the Prohibition era and my conversation with Michael McGurr in just a few moments. Production support for Nightlights comes from Landlocked Music CDs and Vinyl, offering new and used music, DVDs, turntables, and more. Located at 202 North Walnut in Bloomington or online at landlockedmusic.com. And from the Laughing Planet Cafe and Soma Coffee House, offering San Francisco-style burritos, coffee drinks, and 100% fruit smoothies made with locally grown and organic ingredients on the corner of Kirkwood and Grant in Bloomington, Indiana. You can hear many previous Nightlights programs and view playlists on our website at indianapublicmedia.org/nightlights. I'm David Brent Johnson, and you're listening to The Big Speakeasy, Jazz and Prohibition on Nightlights. Playing jazz from the Prohibition era on this edition of Nightlights, historian Michael McGurr, whose book A Fierce Discontent, The Rise and Fall of the Progressive Movement in America, chronicles the times and forces that led up to the age of Prohibition, says there's some irony in the relationship between jazz and Prohibition.
One of the things that's striking to me about the relationship of jazz and Prohibition is that jazz music itself comments relatively little on drink and Prohibition. And it's, in a way, that doesn't mean there's no connection, because we often don't talk about the things that are most significant or most important to us. But there's really only a relative handful of jazz records from the 20s and 30s that are about alcohol. And it's a striking contrast to, say, blues music, which blues musicians in the 20s and 30s did a lot of songs about drink. Country music did a lot of songs about drink. And jazz lives in a world that's defined by drinking and doesn't want to say anything about it, or at least not very often.
Here are several sides that do, through their lyrics or titles, invoke Prohibition or the culture of 1920s drinking, starting off with Bessie Smith and Me and My Gin on Nightlights.
When I glass of gin.
Clarence Williams and his Novelty Four doing In the Bottle Blues with King Oliver on trumpet and Eddie Lang on guitar, recorded in 1928. Before that, the Missourians, a band that would soon turn into the Cab Calloway Orchestra, in 1930 doing Prohibition Blues. And the set started off with Bessie Smith doing Me and My Gin in 1928 from the CD The Essential Bessie Smith. Alcohol wasn't the only non-musical influence on jazz in these years. Michael McGurr on the impact of money and the music's social settings.
One element in the association of jazz and prohibition is that it's forged at a time when the U.S. is fairly prosperous, and many Americans, but far from all, are living better than they have before. Wealthy people were going to cabarets and speakeasies that were very, as people would have said at the time, high class and very glamorous. But that's pretty much a big city phenomenon. And it's in big cities that prohibition can be flouted in an open social way that would create a space for music. But most of those places were living a difficult relationship with the law. To get by and be tolerated, you had to pay people off. So you had to make a good bit of money. And many of these places really were, as I said, dives. And it's not clear how inspiring they were for musicians to play in. Audiences weren't necessarily paying a lot of attention. The big thing to me is that that people were spending more money on entertainment. But that's one of the things that weighed against prohibition in the end, is that people wanted to be able to spend money in a more, what they would think of as more respectable or safer setting. And the 30s showed what that would be. In the middle of a depression, music was present in people's lives in a way that it wasn't as much in the 20s, even though it's a cultural idea.
Kansas City was one city where music flourished in the age of prohibition, as did corruption and organized crime. One of the city's most representative bands was the Benny Moten Orchestra. Here they are doing Moten Swing on Nightlights. Thank you.
Benny Moten's band doing Moten Swing from the CD Bandbox Shuffle. Benny Moten's band a sort of launching pad for what would eventually become the Count Basie Orchestra. By the early 1930s, Prohibition increasingly had come to be seen as a failed social experiment. Though its end was becoming imminent, Michael McGurr says the effects of its association with jazz would linger in the music's reputation for some time.
Well into the 1930s, 40s, and 50s, jazz has this, the establishment of jazz has this urge for respectability, to be viewed as a long hair music, meaning not hippies, but classical musicians. And part of that is a product of the additional time that jazz spent in this cultural purgatory in the 1920s as the music of allegedly disreputable outsiders. So Prohibition does, in a certain way, slow down a process of acceptance, even as it makes jazz a more alluring cultural object to people, because it's still kind of forbidden.
Bessie Smith in 1933, from what would prove to be her last recording session, doing Gimme a Pigfoot and a Bottle of Beer from the CD The Essential Bessie Smith. Lost legend jazz figure Frankie Newton heard there on trumpet. Billie Holiday and Nina Simone would both later record that song as well, though without the reference to reefer in the final lines. Prohibition ended in 1933. By then, the Great Depression had been underway for nearly 4 years. Once again, great cultural changes were in the works. Jazz and America would never be the same again. Michael McGurr.
The Depression's effect is generally negative. You see that especially with the recording industry. Part of the reason that jazz becomes so popular in the 1920s is that the record business really distributes the music in a way that far more extensively than it had been distributed before. People heard the music in the 20s as they'd not heard a music before. The bottom drops out of the record business in the Depression initially, and many jazz musicians who'd been recording prolifically, that dries up. So the Depression creates a very difficult circumstance, but because it brings in Franklin Roosevelt, who in turn, with a Democratic majority, pushes successfully for the end of Prohibition, it means that jazz is going to lose this association that's so problematic with law-breaking, and that it can be played more respectably, especially in middle-class spaces. You think of Glenn Miller and the kind of, you know, the association of jazz with the jukebox and soda, you know, that's a very different thing from the association in the 20s. And for the musicians involved, it was much more lucrative.
Close with the Casa Loma Orchestra doing Happy Days Are Here Again from the CD Casa Loma Stomp. Thanks for tuning in this edition of Nightlights. Special thanks to Michael McGurr. Production support for Nightlights comes from Landlocked Music CDs and Vinyl, located at 202 North Walnut in Bloomington or online at landlockedmusic.com. And from the Laughing Planet Cafe and Soma Coffee House on the corner of Kirkwood and Grant in Bloomington, Indiana. You can listen to previous Nightlights programs and view playlists on our website at indianapublicmedia.org/nightlights. Nightlights is a production of WFIU and part of the educational mission of Indiana University. I'm David Brent Johnson, wishing you good listening for the week ahead.